This is the Dave Duran Show with Dave Duran.
Welcome to the Dave Duran Show, where faith and the workplace meet. We discuss the tips, tools, and resources to help you become a better leader, employee, or entrepreneur. And as always, I'm joined by our host, Dave Duran. We have Matthew Kelly joining us today. If you haven't heard of him, he is an internationally acclaimed speaker, author, and business consultant. His books have been published in more than 30 languages, and they have appeared on the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and USA Today's bestseller lists and have sold more than 50 million copies. Now, today's topic is the biggest career mistakes I see people make. As always, stick around for some listener Q&A where you get to ask the questions and we'll answer them. Send those questions over to dave@leadinggiants.com. For the topic today, Dave, the biggest career mistakes you've seen people make, what are they?
Well, there are a handful of things that people make kind of as one-offs, but these are the biggest ones. And I do want to kind of put the listeners at a little bit at ease because they think, oh, I've made this mistake. Is it fatal? Well, I mean, no. I suppose if you're 70, you're probably at the point where you can't do a whole lot of course correction. But I've seen people make these moves, changes in this, even at 50 or 55 years old. And that's important to remember. So if you've made some of these mistakes when you're much younger, I wouldn't get too worried about them. You can do course correction right now. The first one is not blooming where you're planted. Now, I'm going to extend that, Nico, as an answer. It's not blooming where you're planted, at least for a while, to grow stronger. So I see a lot of people do this. As soon as they get into, you know, actually they kind of are the person who has the pattern of wishing life away altogether. So they're in grade school and they just can't wait till high school so they don't experience grade school. They're in high school and they just can't wait to get to college where they can be on their own. So they just skip past high school. They're in college and they just can't wait to have their career because that's when it's all going to matter. They have their career, but it's not really the career they wanted. So they can't wait to have the better career and on and on and on and on. They never live in the moment. So if you stop and you say, what am I learning here? And I just recently, or you heard me say this in a talk just recently,
yep,
that a lot of times people in college will say, Dave, what job should I get? You know, I want to go into sales or I want to be an attorney or I want to be a doctor. What should I do to prepare for that in college? And my answer is so dissatisfying to them usually. I say, find a job you don't like that's hard manual labor that are long hours that you want to quit. And the reason for that is because really at the end of the day, it's not so much what you do. It's who you become when you do what you do that matters. And I've seen a lot of people have all the knowledge that they need and even start to gain experience, but they don't have what it takes to stick it out. There's going to be a difficult time in work. And if you go into work as a person who's soft without willing to become a little bit more chiseled in what you do and to endure, there are bad things that happened. I mean, for me, I had so many jobs like that, working on the grill at Hardee's. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Landscaping and just working 12-hour days, moving rocks and boulders and cleaning out the bathrooms and the basement of a bar, which was rumored to be haunted besides just gross, by the way. So all sorts of jobs. I mean, countless. I tried naming them all one time and it was unbelievable. Delivering newspapers when I was 10 years old in snowstorms on a bike that would fall over. Wow. And nearing frostbite. And, you know, these are the types of things that if you learn to do them, you become so strong that when you enter into that thing that you really called to do, ultimately speaking, things are going to go better. So you might not have picked the job you really loved right away, or you might have thought it was going to be better than it was. Here's another thing, too. When I see people that go from job to job to job and career to career, and they're dissatisfied in everything they're doing, they fail to look at the common denominator. And that's themselves. And they're just a dissatisfied person. So you have to grow in virtue while you become great. And that's going to make the biggest difference. So I would say that's the first one. Not blooming your plants. Now, that doesn't mean you have to stay in perpetuity in the same place. But what it does mean is if you're going to have a short stay there, really think about that stay and what you're gaining from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And how you're growing in virtue, I think, is a point here that I have to internalize as well. What is the second point here, the second career mistake that you've seen people make?
Well, it's not learning by observation in order to accelerate personal growth and professional acumen. So we are wise to pay attention to the wisdom of others. So if you're in a role that is not the one you want to be in, look at the people who are in the role you want to be in and ask, are they effective? Are they good at it? What makes them good at it? You know, could I do that? What would it take to get there? And just understand and observe those people that are even outside of the role that you're in, and to be studious about this. Now, by the way, I'm deliberate as opposed to saying curious. And I understand why people say curious. I literally have no criticisms of people saying curious, because they usually mean studious. But I also like to point out the difference between the two. Curiosity classically killed the cat. Okay, it's not as effective as studious. People are curious. That's why they scroll through Facebook. They're curious. That's why they watch random things on Netflix that don't matter. When you're studious, you're watching things that make you better, that make you learn, that make you more whole. So I would be studious about it. If you become curious in the workplace, you become a gossip. If you become studious in the workplace, you can actually start to accelerate your learning. And you don't necessarily need to be the person with all the experience you want to gain if you observe the people with the experience you want to gain.
Great, great insights there, Dave. What is the third biggest mistake that you've seen people make?
Failing to build friendships at work. And there's two reasons for this one, and they're big. The first one, I'll just go with a simple one. All of the studies that I've seen, and they come out quite often, over time, demonstrate that the happiest people in the workplace and the companies that have the greatest retention are the ones where there are friendships in the workplace. People like to go see their friend. They enjoy that. And you know what we do with friends all the time is we create problems. Hey, friend, come over to the house and let's play cards. We're going to create a problem between the two of us we need to solve, and my solution is me beating you. Or let's team up and play a game against these other, you know, let's get together with these other two guys. We'll play golf and we have a problem. We need to win against them and we're paired up. So, you know, human beings create problems to solve and we actually grow together because of them. Well, the workplace is perpetual problems. Every job is there because you need to solve a problem. And that's why I say problems are your friends. If you don't have your problems, your job becomes irrelevant. So solve a problem with a friend and it'll bond you to that friend. It'll make things more powerful. But the other reason that friendships are important is because when you're 20 or 22 and you build a friendship in the workplace, that person that you built a friendship with, and you don't do it for utilitarian reason, you do it for the friendship, but you may end up going different ways. 10 years from now, they are in a very good position, or you're in a very good position, and one of you needs somebody like the other person. And so you hire that person or you're hired by that person. And this is the sort of network that you start to see, but it only really happens through real friendships, authentic friendships. And a friend is not some admirer on social media. That's not a friend, even if you call it a friend. You're way better off with a small group of good friends than a massive web of just acquaintances. The thing about friendships, though, is that you have different kind of layers of them. Some of them are going to be lifelong friends, and then others are going to be transient friends. But it makes sense to actually have them be a good friend in that moment, because if it's a true friendship, it will come back to you later on in life, and you will kind of long to see that person again. And that's just it's a beautiful blessing, but it also increases the level of security that you and that friend, and the many other friends you can build that in that capacity. It sounds contradictory to say only have a small group of really good friends as opposed to this massive web, but they're momentary. You know what it's like, Nico? You've got this friend that you've had in life. You haven't seen them forever and you count them as one of your lifelong great friends, yep. But they have this friend that was at a work situation with you, you really liked each other and life just took you in a different place. In the moment there, you're probably spending more time with that friend than your lifelong friend. And you get to conquer and build and all that. And so they'll be a little transient, but they don't necessarily go away. You see that person years later and that is rekindled, even though the effort to rekindle it might not be quite the same as that lifelong friend. So yeah, important.
Yeah, and a friend of yours kind of taught me this, the dear friend, dear friend,
yes.
dear friend category. So it kind of
exactly.
Goes into that. Dave, so we're on point number four, the biggest career mistakes you've seen people make. What's number four?
Yeah, the fourth one is also an important, well, they're all important, but the fourth one is failing to ask. And I want you to listen to how I'm wording this because I'm being a little bit coy when I do it, but it's important. If I think I can do this better than they, then how can I someday become they? If I think I can do this better than they can, really, then how can I somehow become they? Why do I say this? Well, because I always tell people, if you're leading an organization and the team that you are leading starts to use they language, your culture is kind of not in a good spot. It's not we. How are we going to improve this? How are we going to make the situation better? What is our company doing? What are they going to do? You know, what are the owners going to do? How are they making decisions? It separates the two. But if you're the type of person who's thinking you can do it better than they can, which, by the way, Nico, like 95% of the people that I consult with or even call in or send an email think they can do it better than the, well, my boss doesn't do this well and they don't lead well and they treat me poorly. And so I need to make this change. Okay, well, that might very well be true. I don't have a problem with that. I'm certainly not saying from a skeptical perspective that you're wrong, but it is, you know, kind of like looking at leaders is a little bit like gambling in Las Vegas. Everybody comes home saying I broke even or won, but yet we've talked about how all these, you know, $4 million chandeliers aren't paid for by no one. So people are going and losing, but their perception is different than reality. Even if their bank account says otherwise. So a lot of times people sit there and criticize their leader. So I'm like, listen, okay, well, let's talk about first of all, what problem might you be holding in this? I mean, are you a part of this? And if not, fine, that's great. But you got to look there. You got to ask. Quite often it comes true that the person is, no, they're doing the right things and their leader is off. So then if you ask that question, well, how can I become they? How can I advance in this organization so that I am now advancing not for ambitious reasons, but because there's a problem to solve? I see somebody up there. It'd be like if you are an actual qualified pilot and you're on an airplane as a passenger and you notice the pilot is making all sorts of mistakes and they can't fly the plane and you're all in danger. Well, you're not ambitious to try to take over the seat of the pilot. You are actually righteous to do that because you're going to save everybody else involved. So if you're just saying, well, I want to be the boss, that's one thing. But if you're saying, wow, I am driven to get up into this position because I see all sorts of mistakes that are happening and I would be able to help the organization and help the employees and help the vendors and help all the customers and clients if I was in that position of power, that's great. Or this might be your trigger to say, time for me to go on my own and be an entrepreneur. So as opposed to being really frustrated by it, kind of combined that first one and the second one that we talked about and the third one and say, okay, if what, you know, how can I grow through this situation I'm frustrated in? How can I become a bigger, stronger person through it? And I'm going to do that training. The second thing we said is not learning by observation, right? That's a problem. So how can I learn by observation to accelerate my growth? And I'll learn two things, what not to do and what to do. And then can I build friendships while I'm here, while I'm going through this process as well too? And then I'll ask myself, if I think I can do it better than they can, how can I somehow become they? And you will see that you won't be squandering the experiences that you have right now that might be negative. You'll be taking them with you to be a much more empowered leader when you have your chance.
All right. And we have a last point here, Dave. And I think this is crucial as well as the other four points that you just made. But what's that last final point on biggest career mistakes you've seen people make?
Working without a why. This is a huge one. And for me, this is very simple. And I think that you can have several layers of why. You know, well, why did you get in the car to eat lunch? Okay, well, that's a low layer. Okay, but it's urgent and the most important. Well, why did you eat lunch? So that I can be healthy. Well, why do you need to be healthy? Because I have an important job to do and a family to take care of. And if I'm not healthy, I can't take care of them and I need to focus. And why are you taking care of your family and your job? Well, because it's my vocational call and I want to be a good steward to God so I can go to heaven. Oh, that's why you got in your car. Yeah, to go to heaven. So this like kind of transition, if you can't see how those things connect, then you have a problem. So why are you there? And can you connect your highest why to the behavior that you're doing literally right now? Can you thread it all the way to the higher why? And that's a very important thing to be able to do.
Well, that's a great list. The biggest career mistakes you've seen people make, Dave, and this is not an exhaustive list by any means, but I think it's a very crucial starting place for most of us here listening on the Dave Duran Show. We'll be right back with Matthew Kelly after this short break.
This is the Dave Duran Show with Dave Duran.
Welcome back to the Dave Duran Show here on Relevant Radio. Today's guest is Matthew Kelly. We're honored to have Matthew as our guest on this episode of the Dave Duran Show. Matthew, of course, known for authoring books like Dynamic Catholic, Rediscovering Catholicism, and Resisting Happiness. Dozens and dozens of books. He's a best-selling author. He's a keynote speaker, a business consultant. So he really knows how to dive deep into organizational leadership, how to integrate your Catholic faith into your work life, and your work life into your Catholic faith. He'll touch on a few topics here today with us. This is a short segment of an hour-long interview that we conducted with Matthew Kelly not too long ago, and that interview will be available on Dave's YouTube channel, Durand On Demand. But this segment specifically for our Relevant Radio listeners will touch on two topics. Number one, how his Catholic faith has played a pivotal role in obviously everything that he does. And number two, how silence integrates well into his life and how really that was the springboard for him being able to write all the books that he's been able to write over the last couple of years. So take it away, Dave.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about what gets in the way. And that would be, you know, knowing something about yourself and knowing something about a circumstance that you don't want others to know. You're kind of hiding it, what gets in that way. It might be self-apparent to ask the opposite question, which is, well, what is the thing that fuels success? When you look at the people that have had the most success, the long-term success, not just one-hit wonder-oriented things, what would you attribute? You're sitting down and you're talking to your kids and you said, if there's this one thing, one character trait that I would tell you need to have, and if you need to pick two or three, fine. What would you say that is?
I'll pick two. One would be silence. You can't get enough silence to fuel success. Silence is the most naturally clarifying state the human being can experience. And so it's like we all want more clarity, but this is actually something that will give you clarity. You don't have to do anything, but the hardest thing in the world is not to do anything. And so
what is it? What happens here in entering into that?
So let's say that this hand represents the soul or the essence of who you are, the self, whatever you want to call that for now is fine. And then this hand represents the conscious mind. The conscious mind is always being distracted by the things you do, the things you see, the things you hear, all the things you think about, constantly distracting. What happens in the silence, okay, and silence in and of itself is a form of meditation. Okay, so we're not talking about going off and doing a 10-week course in meditation. Just sitting silently in and of itself puts this process into effect. So you've got the soul very, very still, your essence. You've got the conscious mind constantly being distracted. The more you spend time in silence, this begins to slow down, okay? And this begins to slow down when this gets still, the two meet. That's what the great mystics of every age would have referred to as union with God, and that's where the magic happens. And so when you go into the silence, you don't have to make an attempt to slow your mind down. That's not necessary. You know, I would say take a notepad if you're one of those people that a lot of things come to your mind. If it's going to be distracting to your silence, take a notepad. If you remember, oh, I got to make that doctor's appointment, write it down. If you remember, oh, I got to pick up milk, write it down. So that at the end of your silence, you have these things, but they're not going to keep coming back during your silence or during your meditation because you haven't written them down. You've written them down and now you can let them go. And until you're done. And what that does is that allows this to slow down. And it takes time. It takes practice like anything else. You have to get used to it. The first thing I would say is silence. Second thing I would say is reading. And I would say reading across a broad spectrum. So, you know, not just reading in your industry, you know, not just reading business books. If you want to understand human nature, read fiction. You most likely will not understand human nature by reading nonfiction. You will understand human nature by reading fiction. You're much likely to develop emotional intelligence by reading fiction, the classics, than by reading a book on emotional intelligence. Not that you shouldn't read that as well, but to read across a broad spectrum. You know, I like reading psychology. I'm looking at my books. I got 100 books in my office. That this is the 100. I've got 7,000 books, but this is the 100. And each year I go in, I switch some in and switch some out. But I've got business books. I've got personal development books. I've got children's books. I've got history books. I've got spiritual books. I've got creative books, like creative process. I'm fascinated with the creative process of all arts. I've got philosophy books. I've got psychology books. I've got fiction, and then I've got my books for reference.
All right, well, that takes up 37. There's only 63 other books there.
Yeah.
So I want to just dive directly into, you know, what it means to you to be a Catholic and how you go about what you do in that regard. So my son is going to be ordained a priest in May. And he and two seminarians came down to the house, and we were just enjoying a cigar last night and talking about the way the world is. And one of the things I was talking about is how many people pit two good things against each other, and they have a false choice. I would be the number one salesperson, but I'm a family guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've just indicted every great salesperson as a bad family person. That's one thing. And second of all, what you don't realize is that what makes you bad at sales is also what makes you bad at your family. Yeah. So why don't you commit to both and make it happen? And this idea that we have to choose, like people only read the part of the gospel that says sell everything. Oh, okay. So that if I'm going to be a Christian follower, then I have to now run from the fact that I'm a lawyer or I'm a surgeon or I'm a performer and I'm an entrepreneur and I have income. No. What you need to do instead is integrate these things and have detachment. But how do you help people? Because I would imagine that you don't just help people, but you have to go through this process yourself, right? Speak to that. Speak to your faith in the context of what we talked about is in entrepreneurship and career and not focusing on balance, but integration. I mean, you've got a lot to say on this, and I'd kind of like you to take the floor.
Yeah, I think to start with, I think it's worth commenting on, you know, the rich young man who was told to sell everything, you know, because for entrepreneurs, like that's very often a passage that gets thrown at them, right? And when you read that passage, like this guy was pressing Jesus. That wasn't Jesus's first answer. He came to Jesus and said, what I got to do to earn eternal life? Jesus says this. He said, I'm already doing that. He says, what else I got to do to eternal life? Jesus says, all right, well, this. He says, I'm already doing that. What else I got to do? So he's like pressing Jesus. He's raising the stakes on himself. Jesus wasn't raising the stakes on him, you know. And what he was essentially saying was, I want to be the 1% of the 1% of the best of anyone who does this. And so I think it is important to understand that Jesus wasn't saying to everyone what he said to the rich young man. The second thing I would say is, I think about explaining sort of my position on faith is, if you think about like an organizing principle, every society needs an organizing principle, okay? Now, in our society, that organizing principle is law, and in many respects, capitalism. It is one of those laws, but it is law primarily. But, you know, an organizing principle in a corrupt culture could be greed. An organizing principle could be dictatorship. An organizing principle, it could be anything, right? I think that the best organizing principle in any human society would be virtue, okay? And not even in the spiritual sense, but in the classical Greek sense, okay? I think virtue is the ultimate organizing principle for any group of people, because the truth is laws are only necessary where love fails. Okay. You know, when our love runs out, then we need laws. And of course you need that because you can't, you know, just organize around the other. So, I look at Catholicism as an organizing principle for my life. One of the questions great philosophers have asked in every age, and we all ask indirectly, even if we never articulate the question, is how is the best way to live? I believe that, you know, the Gospels of Jesus, he just presents the best way to live. And if you could convince me right now that God doesn't exist, Jesus is a myth, and none of that stuff is true, I would still believe that the Gospels, as laid out, is actually the best way to live. I don't think any time in history we've come up with a better way to live. And I look at that from a number of perspectives. I look at it, how it affects me when I actually live it. Well, that's when I get into position of thriving. That's when I get into position of flourishing. That's when I am closest to the best version of myself. And I also look at it from the perspective of other people. You know, if everybody on the planet live the Gospels, what would the world be like? Okay, that may not be possible, but it's easy to imagine, and the imagining is a very positive thing. Whereas if you look at some people's worldviews and you say, hold on a minute, if everyone on the planet lived that way, what would the world be like? Again, it is not difficult to imagine, and it's a hellish place, you know? And so, for me, my faith tends to be very pragmatic. It tends to be, this really works. You know, this has worked for a lot of people for a long, long time. And the idea that I'm going to think up something, like a way of life, an organizing principle that works better than this, requires the arrogance of, you know, all the Greek gods.
That is a huge statement. Now, you can maybe help me with this, because it's probably been three times on the show that I've quoted this, and I can't remember. I think it was Chesterton who said, even if I were not Catholic, I would still want, and it was something like my accountant and my doctor and my neighbor to be. And that's kind of the principle that you said right there, right? That's good living. And I think it's like a total strategic advantage. You know, we don't believe in the health and wealth gospel. You know, God is not transactional with us. It's not that we pray more, so he's going to give us a bigger house. Okay, we tithe more, so he's going to give us a better car. That's a false teaching. But there is a natural law and human nature combination of things which says, if I'm honest, if I'm hardworking, if I eat right, if I exercise, if I sacrifice, my odds of success are way higher.
Yes.
We know that because the Stoics and the completely agnostic people who promote self-help will promote those same principles, which ultimately speaking take you to the highest level. So you articulated that whole idea. And you know, the whole thing too is like, I think that key thing is to what end? You know, like, to what end? The transcendentals, I teach people in business, and I don't care what faith you have or not, we have a universal desire for goodness, truth, unity, and beauty. And beauty contains three things. It contains, you know, symmetry, proportion. It has clarity. You know, it has integrity. And that was more than three because I was using synonyms for a few of them. There could be no greater way to raise standards putting together a business plan to have integrity, proportion, perspective, that is, and clarity. There would be no greater way to build a team and have a mission statement than to have unity. And these things are universally attractive, but they are not just attractive for what they are. They're attractive because we want more of every one of this. And so that, I think, the inevitable thing of living the life that you're talking about gets you to ask the inevitable, you know, existential question. Why? You know, talk a little bit about that when you meet people that are either not in their faith or are in different places in their faith, to help lead them a little closer to that clarity.
I think that when you obsess about, let's say, a material possession or an accomplishment, and you get there, okay, or you achieve whatever the accomplishment is, or you get the car or the house or whatever, it's an amazingly short period of time before those things are well and truly in the rear view mirror and have nowhere near the meaning that they had prior to getting them. Okay. Things that are good, true, and beautiful have more meaning after you get them than they did before you got them. And and so, yeah, I believe, like, this life is astounding, but the idea that we just die and that's just it, I'm just not capable of getting my head around that. But even if that were the case, then we would still ask the question, how is the best way to live? And the best way to live is one moment at a time. You know, my last bestseller is called Holy Moments. And it was just the idea that Some moments are holy, some moments are unholy. You get to decide. You know, you're capable of collaborating with God and creating holy moments. And you do it one at a time. And the truth is, life is just made up of moments. And, you know, we call them holy moments, or you call them something else. Some have high value, some have low value, some have negative value. And we know the difference. And so to look at back at the day and say, okay, what were the high value moments? What were the negative value moments or the low value moments? And then to cast out into tomorrow, trying to create more of those holy moments, those high value moments. For me, it just makes sense. I also have no need to force it upon anyone. I think a lot of people are very insecure in their faith. I think a lot of people are, this is what I believe. I really need you to believe this. I don't have that. I'm happy to share with anyone who wants to listen. But my desire to force it on anybody is like zero.
Yeah, you can't force love. You can't force that. I think that zeal, you know, clearly you have a zeal for this sort of thing. You're writing to bring people closer to Christ on a daily basis. There's the desire to have an endless passion for sharing something you love. I mean, there's a difference between, you know, I'm going to beat you into submission believing what I believe is very different than, oh my gosh, I am so excited about this. I'm so happy about this. I can't believe what I have. I have to share with you. I think you're going to love it. No, I don't like that kind of pie. You should taste it. It is unbelievable. No, I don't know. I'm telling you, once you taste this pie, you're going to love it. Well, there's a certain amount of like forgivable enthusiasm there, right?
Yes.
And that's very different than taking their head and cramming the pie into it and forcing an experience. So I think that there's a beautiful blend to that. There's an attraction to the person who is inviting as opposed to imposing.
Well, and I think there's a very simple litmus test. You know, when you, the first thing you said was writing for people and then da 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 da. Well, it's for people. Like, you have to be for people. You have to be interested in what's best for them. You have to be interested in what's next for them. You have to be interested in their well-being. You have to be interested in people, you know? And so the idea that you talk to, like, people who consider themselves very religious, and then they're like, yeah, but I don't really like people, you know?
How can that be?
Or even religious leaders, and you realize, okay, yeah, they have this role, but it doesn't look like he actually likes human beings.
No, yeah. So there's subtlety in this. Yeah, and there's a huge subtlety. Like, people who pray, Lord, please help them agree with me. That is a vastly different thing than, Lord, please help them see the truth, or for me to see the truth. I mean, hugely different. Lord, please help my next book become a New York Times bestseller for the people. Well, there's a little bit of mix in there. There's a little bit of both. Yeah, you wrote it for the people, but you don't mind having a little bit of prosperity. And God knows the mix of both of those in our human condition. And I think being just real with God in conversation matters here. So, okay, let me ask you this. You have an opportunity to just take the next whatever couple of minutes to share whatever has been left out of this conversation that we should have talked about with the audience. What would you tell them?
Oh, I don't know that I'd look at the conversation and say anything's been left out. I think it's been a great conversation. I think that, what would I tell them? Keep asking yourself questions. Challenge people in your life to tell you the brutal truth about whatever your situation is. Most people struggle to tell the brutal truth about anything. The people closest to us struggle to point it out to us because, you know, they love us. They don't want to hurt us. They don't want to upset us. But if you invite it, it is an invitation. If you know the brutal truth of a situation or an opportunity or a challenge or a problem, then you can solve for that brutal truth. If you don't know that brutal truth, you'll solve for something else, but it will be only a partial solution because you've only partially defined the problem or the opportunity.
Thank you, Matthew, and we will be right back after this short break with our Q&A segment where you get to ask the questions and we will answer them here on Relevant Radio. Welcome back to the Dave Durant Show. This is our Q&A section where you get to ask the questions and we answer them. Feel free to send questions to Dave at leadinggiants.com. We'll review them weekly and answer them on air. So we got a question from Veronica this week, Dave. She's basically getting at that she provides an associate she works with who manufactures designs tees with her idea for a t-shirt, but she can't seem to get an answer as to how they should structure the deal financially. Do you have any thoughts? And so for context here, she is creating the design. She has a website to sell it on, and she plans on selling it as well at small venues and hopefully to others wholesale. So how would you structure this deal for the person who manufactures slash designs the tees with her idea, Veronica's idea for the t-shirt?
Okay, so there's a little confusion in here. So let me separate a couple of different things, and I think I can make this work. She's saying it's her idea, but somebody else is designing it. Right. If it was her idea and she were a designer and somebody was just manufacturing it, it would be very, very simple. It's still going to be probably just as simple. She owns this. I mean, Veronica owns this. A manufacturer is not going to participate in ownership. They're just going to tell you how much it costs to manufacture. And this is the way the world works in virtually every other product. I have an idea. I'm putting the idea together. I need a manufacturer for that. I'm going to hire you for it. Tell me how much you're going to charge per unit. And then I'm going to mark that unit up and I'm going to sell it. And so the only relationship we have is a contract for you to manufacture it, but it has nothing to do with ownership lines being crossed. What makes this one curious to me that I have to ask about is that this manufacturer is also designing it. That's not highly problematic, nor is it unusual. But it just means how much of that design is not actually yours, that you're not really owning it. So if you're designing a t-shirt, the interesting thing is you have an idea about a t-shirt, but they're doing the design. Now, again, people have ideas and they contract designers. And it's the same exact thing. You own the design if the agreement you have with the designer is that you are contracting them to design something that you will now own and they don't own. But you need to work that out. I would say that the way that you would want to do this is 100% to go to them as simply a supplier. They're going to be your design company. They're going to be your manufacturer. You own your own company. You own your own brand. They give you a price. You negotiate that price on the t-shirts that they're providing for you, and you sell them for a profit wherever you go. And if they're selling them on their website and you're selling them on your website, you would allow both to do that, but you would retain the ownership of that, and you would make sure that you're getting your particular royalty from them as it's being sold because it is your brand and your idea, and they're just sharing in some revenue on that. But you'd want to make sure that if there's confusion between these, that you button it up. Now, I would say that one of the problems here is that you're saying you're not hearing back from them. Well, the reason you're not hearing back from them is that in this sort of circumstance, you need to tell them. This is one of those times as a business person, you say, here are my terms. I'm going to you with a product that I own, and I simply need you to manufacture the product and to do some design work. What is your fee for that? And then when they give you the fee, then if you want to negotiate, you can say, how much better can you do than that? And then you can get a better rate. Or you would go to other manufacturers and designers and shop it around and see if you can get a better rate from either one of them. But don't make this too complex. I would keep it simple.
If you have further questions for Dave that pertain, again, feel free to send those over to dave@leadinggiants.com. We'll move to our second question from Eric. He says, I found it difficult to identify the right leaders to work for or partner with at management and executive levels. The business owner and or management team represents that they have a strong culture, formal business practices, and a focused vision and mission. But after starting to work with the company, I have found this to be far from true. What advice do you have for somebody going through interviews to help them ensure that they are properly evaluating the hiring company's management team in a savvy, non-naive way?
Well, What the beauty of answering a question like this is that it's anonymous. And because it's anonymous, I can explore it on many different, very, very important levels. But you will hear a theme from me whenever I get a question like this. And the theme always comes back. And I do this myself, by the way. This is the way I operate independently. When I have a negative opinion about other people, particularly other people in a leadership role, I ask myself, could I be missing something? Is there a deficit that I have right here? Do they have a standard that I'm unwilling to meet, and therefore I'm justifying it by pointing the finger back at them? Because you have to get past that first. Now, I will also say that as much as this might be troubling to people, I see this as the biggest problem most of the time. I mean, I'm not a cynic, and I'm not a skeptic, and I'm certainly not negative about consulting with people because I want to help them grow. But one of the ways that I help them grow is I point out that their standard is not the problem. Their problem is that you won't meet their standard. And instead of accepting that, you're throwing stones at them. And I've literally seen this. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. This may not be the case of the particular person who is asking the question here. So I'm going to get to the other side of it too. There's two sides to this. Not everybody's on the side, but examining your own conscience is super important because self-justifying is a big thing. I have not known one or two or three, but many people who are working remote and don't do their job. They are late. They are doing other things instead of the job that they're supposed to be doing. I know that because I've seen them throughout the day bragging about it. Oh, yes, I love working remote because I can go to the beach and I can do this and I can do that. And they never know. And I just send some emails, some, you know, prime times to get there. And so I know that. And that's one of the reasons I've never quit this job is that I love all of this flexibility that I have. Then their manager will call and say something about their performance or that they have an expectation that they attend a meeting in person for the first time and for whatever. And now they say, can you believe they want me to go to this meeting? Can you believe they criticize my work? They are so ridiculous. Their standards are so bad. And they, it's like a stark contrast. I mean, I've seen people who are supposed to be working full time work 10 or 12 hours lazily, be called into a meeting in a once a month fashion that would just require them getting out of their pajamas and going and being responsible for like 2 hours. And now they're just like taking shots at leadership for having this unreasonable standard. And you're like, do you hear yourself? Okay, so just consider that. Now there's a second side of this. Second side is that the leadership is bad. They did mislead you and they knew exactly what to say to lure you in. And now you're in and you want to leave because you don't like it there. How do you discern this? Well, I think life experience helps you discern it is one thing because you start to understand patterns and language of people who do things. But when you're in the interview process, you can ask a lot of questions on your side of things that help illuminate this. An interview really is both ways. You're interviewing the company to see if you want to work there, and they're interviewing you to see if they want you to work there. Now, if you take some sort of an arrogant perspective and interviewing them, hey, listen, sit down, buddy, I got questions for you too, that's going to be so off-putting that you have now probably eliminated your opportunity to work there. But for you to ask sincere questions about the organization makes a whole lot of sense. Why do people like working here? It's a great question. You're going to hear that. Oh, okay. When you look at, your senior people, how long did it take them to advance? How do you enable opportunities for people in that regard? Well, you know what? We hire our senior people from outside. Okay. Well, if nobody's advancing from within, what does that say? It says that they can't develop talent and it says that people don't want to be there. So you can learn these sorts of questions while you're there. But if you hear things like, you know what? Our senior leadership, they've all started kind of entry level. They've been here for 30 years on average. Well, if that's the culture that you're in and you're saying that all the leaders are bad, it's probably not the case. But if the culture is just a rotation of people coming in and out without any retention and the voluntary turnover is super high, yeah, it probably is the leaders. It's going to be experience that does that. But I would say that the more we deceive ourselves about our own values and qualities and our virtue, and the more we can't see our vice, the much easier prey we are to be deceived. if you know yourself very, very well and you have a high level of virtue, you're going to be less inclined to be deceived. And that's, I think, an important way of looking at this.
Eric, and if you have follow-up questions, again, feel free to send those over to dave@leadinggiants.com. This is the last question we have, Dave. This is from Jessica. She asks, Dave, I have a job offer that requires me to move to a city I'm neutral about. The change would be good for me as I've been a director of communications at a parish in a small college town. This job would be a contract job for 12 months and would be a lower-level administrative job, but I take a $12,000 pay cut. I want to end up working in marketing and communications, and the move would allow me the flexibility of exploring part-time opportunities in this space. How would you handle making this decision?
I would ask, do you have a family? Are there people who you need to provide for? What are you going to learn in the new role and responsibility? Is the new role and responsibility appealing and attractive to you, mostly because you now have access to more time, which allows you to enter into the thing that you want to do? And I would ask several other questions. But if your major outcome is that you wanted to get into something other than both of these things that you're currently in, which is what it sounds like, it sounds like you want to leave the thing you're doing. The thing that you would be going to is less pay, but greater opportunity to finally get to the thing that it is you want to do. I would look at that thing you want to do, ultimately speaking, and ask whether or not you can go from here to there by skipping this step. And one of the ways you can do that is to learn the very thing it is that you want to do, maybe even entrepreneurially do it on your own, or to be a contract freelance worker with somebody a couple of days a week on the evening or the weekend and squeeze in that a little extra time, not reduce your pay, but increase your pay because you're doing contract work in addition to the current pay that you have right now. This would allow you to maybe save a certain amount of money to bridge that gap. So if your living expenses were $5,000 a month, I don't know what they are. I don't know if you're married. I don't know anything about this right now. Okay. But if they were $5,000 a month as a single person and you were able to, see what you're suggesting right now is more or less that you've got a little bit of cushion if you can take the $12,000 decreased pay and get a part-time job, because part-time jobs generally don't pay as well as others. So there's some cushion there. Whatever that cushion is, save that, earn a little bit more, and maybe you can build up a 3 or 4 month window that you can now make a full move to go into something else. But I would definitely look at the familial aspect of this, because suffering for your work is a good thing. Forcing people who shouldn't suffer for your work is not necessarily a good thing. And, I always tell men, for example, that you want to carry that burden on your own. And especially if you're going to be an entrepreneur and you want to kind of bridge the gap, you want to go for, and this isn't necessarily about entrepreneurship, they haven't said, but there's an insinuation that it might be. That if you want to like open a company while you're working full time in order to, you know, have a proof of concept that you're going to leap from one thing to the next, it's a good idea to come home from work at a reasonable time to have dinner with the family and to participate in family life, play with the kids, help with the dishes. And then when things settle in and people are asleep, grind out 2 hours worth of work before you go to bed. Wake up early on a Saturday and get some of that sort of thing done so that you can not ever look back and regret things because you just abandoned your family to chase something that they shouldn't have had to suffer from. Your kids shouldn't necessarily be the ones that suffer being absent of a parent because you had higher aspirations. Because for most of the time, if you were to ask them, what would you have rather had, mom or dad around for dinner, or, you know, the lifestyle you were afforded a little later, they usually would want mom and dad around, not to mention the fact that you can shape them more that way. So there's a lot of considerations in this question.
All right. So great insights here, Dave. And Jessica, if you have any further follow-up questions, again, I just encourage everyone to send those questions over to dave@leadinggiants.com. That wraps up this week's episode of The Dave Durand Show. A big thanks to our guest, Matthew Kelly, for joining us this week. This Dave Durand Show episode is available on podcast platforms an hour after the airing time. So make sure to give it a 5-star rating and subscribe to Dave on YouTube @Durand On Demand. We'll see you next week. God bless.